from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour was made in Manhattan in the late 1970s. While working his way into the jazz scene, Kenny Werner did what many young musicians and artists do. He took the kind of work to pay the bills. Weddings, bar mitzvahs, since he was 11, 13 years old. Just imagine if that were your wedding or your bar mitzvah. As a friend of mine said this morning, I could now look back and say Kenny Werner played it, because Kenny Werner's become a highly regarded pianist, composer, and author. You could say he wrote the book for improvising musicians, and his work has captured human emotion on some of the deepest scales. Today, Kenny Werner's back in Rochester playing the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival this afternoon, 4 p.m. at the Lyric Theater. But first, he's my guest on Connections. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we were just talking before the hour started. You've been in Rochester for this festival before. It's been a number of years now. I don't know how much of a chance you've had to walk around it, but does it feel any different this time?
It just feels a lot bigger. God. And I'm glad it's so popular, because it sounds like every place people are going crazy to go hear the music.
All the, you know, Rochesterians love to ask performers like yourselves, you know, who are you going to check out, as if you've got all this spare time?
Well, since I'm playing at 4, I was going to go check out the group that Jean-Michel Pilk is playing in. And then I might check out Fred Hirsch. These are both old friends. And then I think I'll have had enough piano trio by then. I'll go back to my room.
It is a remarkable week in the size and the scope of it. And Kenny Werner was, in many ways, a child prodigy yourself. We had a child prodigy here this week. Joey Alexander was here, the 11-year-old. You had a chance to check out some of his work. Pretty remarkable 11-year-old.
Yes, absolutely.
What do you see in that 11-year-old?
Well, I was just saying before, it's almost like, and there's other guys like him today where it's amazing. There didn't used to be used to be one person. And now if you go through, if you go through YouTube, you find these young kids. Reincarnation is the only thing that explains it for me. They must have been here before, and they must have been musicians, and they came back and picked up where they left off. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
And you don't say that glibly. You mean that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I had the experience with Julian Lage, a young guitar player, but he came, his teacher brought him to me at 11 years old and said, "You got to play with him." I said, "Man, another one of these guys, you know." And when we started playing, I had to rub my eyes and say, "Wait a minute, this guy looks like he has an experience and a wisdom that he could never have acquired in this lifetime." And that's when I started to think, I believe in reincarnation anyway, so I started to think, well, that's the only actually logical. If you accept reincarnation, then that's the most logical explanation.
And so where were you in a past lifetime?
Boy, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out where I was earlier in this one.
But as someone who believes in it, have you had any experience or thought that pushes you in it?
I had somebody tell me some stuff that I have no idea whether it was true or not. Some pretty auspicious stuff, but who knows? It doesn't really matter. I accept the concept that souls evolve over lifetimes. So it doesn't really matter who I was. The question is, what am I learning this time around?
Talking to Kenny Werner, and as a child yourself, you were playing. What are your memory? What are your earliest memories of playing?
Well, I had a record out when I was 11 myself, but it was a little more of a commercial thing, kind of like Roger Williams. We used to have these pianists that were very tasty pianists, but they were like Liberace, but with taste, you know. And that's really what I came up hearing. I didn't really start becoming a jazz player in earnest. I don't really consider myself one now, actually. I just kind of play music. But, you know, before I was really ensconced in the thing is when I went to Berkeley, you know. But before that, I played the music I heard, and I played probably commercial music, because I heard stuff off the radio. And then started to just make my own arrangements of it. And I had a record out then, and it was then it was big news. So I did some TV shows, mm-hmm. and I had an act, because I used to play kind of a stride piano. That's what I learned first. My father only had one jazz pianist that he really liked. It was Fats Waller. So I heard a lot of Fats Waller, and I thought that's the way you played, with the left hand pumping to the left and the right like that. So it wasn't until junior high school that I learned to stop doing that. So when I was 11, I had this act. I would play this real fast, what they called honky-tonk, but we would call it stride piano. And I wore like a checkered shirt with garters on my arms and a straw hat. And it was pretty impressive for a little pudgy kid to be playing, you know, like that. But my father, wherever he is, probably says, you should have just kept playing that, you know, because people really get that, you know.
Well, but and I do want to eventually in this conversation touch on if it matters what people get. Well, because frankly, it was a couple of weeks ago we talked to Herb Alpert on this program. And Herb is not only a musician, but Herb is an artist in many, many different forms. He sculpts, he paints.
Right.
And Herb states he thinks 5 out of 10 people don't even have a clue what any piece of art really is about. And only 1 or 2 out of 10 are really going to connect it with it, but he doesn't care. He said, I don't make the art just to make someone connect with it. I'm doing it for me, and if you connect with it, that's great. And I wonder if you...
I'll take it this way.
Yeah.
All I have to turn myself on with the art, and that's the best way for them to get it. So in a sense, I cannot worry if they get it, because that's how they won't get it. Because just like a person that's trying to say something in a conversation, and they're hoping that they sound good to everybody else. Well, that's usually the guy that gets marginalized just by the fact that they're not coming from within, but they're trying to reach people. You know, that kind of makes people turn a deaf ear. So I found that I do think the audience gets it on some level or another. I can't quote statistics, but what I am sure of is that when I go to play, I can't be preoccupied with whether they're getting it or not. I have to be completely consumed with what's the next note that would turn me on. And if I get caught up in my own little sensual world of notes and harmonies, you know, I can't even think styles. If I think jazz, I get uninspired. If I think other pianists, if I think piano, I get uninspired. To me, it's an orchestra, and I'm just moving around, and the sounds are turning me on in different ways. And when I finally look up, if I've gotten down in there, usually everybody gets it. But if I get out there and I go, gee, there's a lot of great piano players on this festival. Gee, I better play good today. that's what my book is about. But that's exactly when I'll overplay, and you won't quite reach anybody. So I don't know about what Herb said, and I know Herb too. How I would say it.
Can I read a quote from Herb Alpert about Kenny Warner's book? Herb called it, quote, the definitive book on how to free your creative soul, and added, I'm so glad I had a chance to study with him.
Yeah, about that? His secretary called me and said, this is Herb Alpert's secretary. Are you kidding? Kenny Warner wrote the book. This was years before when I didn't really get that how this book was really serving the planet already.
By the way, the book is 1996 now, almost 20 years old. The book is Effortless Mastery, Liberating the Master Musician Within.
By the way, now I'm the artistic director of the Effortless Mastery Institute at Berklee College. So that's kind of a nice thing. We're going to really try to make something out of this. But anyway, he calls me and I'm thinking, are you the Kenny, the secretary says, are you the Kenny Warner that wrote this book? And I went to Herb Alpert. So then he calls me back. I said, yes. And he calls me back and I'm sort of stammering. And he said, look, I'm going to call you later. Why don't you get yourself together? Herb said to me, why don't you get yourself together and then we can talk? I really want to find out what's... So he called me back. He said, man, I read your book and I played the best gig of my life the other night. What's up with this? And by then I composed myself. I realized he's calling me because it's something I've been channeling. I won't say teaching. I've been channeling a message that I don't even control when it comes out. And by the way, that's the way I hope I play, you know. And all I have to do is go into that channel, and he'll get the information that he's looking for. And so I told him that, and his heart was stimulated by that. And we did lessons. He actually flew out to New York, and I was living in Jersey, and drove up to Jersey for a few lessons. And then whenever I was in L.A., I went out to his house, saw a lot of his sculpture, actually. It's incredible. And gave him a few lessons out there. I gave him one lesson in L.A. where his office is. So, and him and Lanny, I love them. They're just so sweet.
And they, of course, performed here at the Jazz Festival on Saturday night. Great performance from Herb and Lanny. I'm doing my best not to speak for Herb Alpert here. But Kenny, what you seem to be saying is when you are performing, you can't spend the performance looking out at the audience going, are they getting this? Are they digging this? You're locked into what you're doing.
That's a powerless place to be.
Right, so you're locked into what you're doing, and then maybe when it's over, you look up and they're going nuts, and you go, boy, they must have been really digging that.
I don't think of it. I guess in that way, I agree with Herb. I just don't think of it because I have to turn myself... Playing is a profoundly selfish act. It's kind of getting yourself off.
But apart from
and
the
ordered, actual... In order for them to get it.
Okay,
that's what I'm trying
but
to say.
Apart from the actual inside the body of the performance, an hour later, do you look back and say, I care whether they got it or not?
Not those terms. You know, they do get it. If I went to my space, if I went in my space, they get it. you know, it's not worth noting in retrospect. Hmm. Maybe if I was starting out and I was trying to gauge audience reaction or something, you know, but now it's more like, you know, I mean, I get that they got it. I'm happy they got it. I mean, obviously, if they don't get it, I'm not going to be playing. I am a populist. I do want them to get it. I just can't let that be the thought when I'm about to play. I have to think, you know, oh, that note, that felt good. Oh, those two notes together. Nice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And just admire what's coming through. I don't even like the sense that I'm playing it. I like the sense that I'm watching it.
What a beautiful description. Kenny Warner performing today at the Lyric Theater, 4 p.m. today at the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. You want to give us a quick 60-second preview of what people will see a couple hours from now, Kenny?
They will see me sitting down and vibrating with the first note and then seeing what note wants to come from that. They will see me, hopefully, receiving some music for all of us.
And can you teach creativity? I ask that because you said you work with Herb, you work with people. That's part of what the book was about. But can you teach creativity?
No, but I don't know. Maybe someone else would say yes, but I know that you can remove the blocks between you and the creativity that most certainly exists inside you. I think that world is filled with nothing but creative people. They're divided by those who know it and those who don't. And the ones that don't know it is because they have a different image of themselves, and that's the block.
So in order to sort of unleash creativity, it's not about telling someone, hey, now go be creative. It's figuring out what the obstacles are to that creativity and finding a way to...
If they get the blocks between, you know, which is usually their mental thoughts out of the way, and if they're prepared to love the sound they make, no matter what it is, they'll find themselves fall into a stream of creativity that most certainly exists within them, or else they wouldn't be breathing.
Kenny Warner is, don't call him a jazz pianist. He's a pianist, a composer, an author. And, you know, you've said that all someone's style is what they're attracted to. That's what you said.
Yes, which is pretty much what I was just saying.
Yeah. And so what are you attracted to these days?
I can't put a word on it. It's this, I'm attracted to the sound. I'm attracted to the sensuality of pressing the buttons on the piano. The other day I was talking to a pianist and he was talking about it. He just found out from this famous teacher that his thumb was in the wrong place. And I said, great, but you know, when I'm doing things that are pleasurable, I don't think about where my thumb is. You know? I'll put it that way.
A little too technical?
Well, it's just that if I don't really, and that's great if that's how he relates to it. For me, I put my hands on the keyboard and I first notice the sensual feeling, I like to touch this. I like touching that. And then the sound that comes out, instead of judging, here's the crucial junction. If I judge, is this the clever, and pianists, you know, they all want to be the most brilliant thing you've ever met. You know, something about quality of pianists. They want to be the most brilliant person in the room. So if I say, is this the brilliant music that a brilliant piano player should be making? I can't play anything at all. If I drop all that and just accept the first sound and then the next sound, I could be led to an improvisation that doesn't end till I open my eyes, you know, not open my eyes, but till I kind of come out of it, you know. So I have to receive it. If I try to analyze it, that just closes the faucet for me.
It reminds me of, and this is a sort of a strange analogy, but bear with me here. It reminds me of, I've had friends in Europe who coach soccer, football, and they say, boy, Americans are so technical. They want everything to be so technically perfect, and they totally obstruct any beauty. They obstruct creativity and flow and beauty. And if you want to see the American soccer program break through, stop obsessing over technicality and allow some beauty to come into the game. And I thought, boy, it almost sounds like what we're talking about here.
Well, that's a way of saying it. Actually, the guy that was talking technique was French, oddly enough. But I don't know about American, European, but I will say that there's a time for the mind, and that is when you're working on technique. And then there's a time for something I call the space. You want to call it the spirit, if you want to call it your God, whatever. If it's Charlie Parker speaking through you, whatever you think it is. To me, we design that space. And when it's time to practice, I use my mind with economy, you know, guide myself and judge, because I'm trying to judge whether the thing I'm practicing has been learned. And when it's time to play, it's time to let go of all that and just fall into a flow that I'm... The only way I can fall into that flow is by kind of surrendering in a way. I mean, it's not unique, new language, but it's the language I apply to how I get there. You know, I mean, I have to let go of something. But so in other words, when I practice, it's mostly mind and thinking. When I play, it's mostly that space, that God space or that super conscious space. Or for me, I just call it the space. And it's a space beyond the mind. And from there, every note I play sounds like the most beautiful sound I've ever heard.
Talking to Kenny Warner, a pianist, a composer. And to be clear, then, at 4 p.m. at the Lyric Theater today, when you perform in Rochester, how much are you even aware right now of what you will be doing when you perform?
Yeah, no, I'm really not. I'm not one of those guys that has a lot of prepared solo piano pieces. For me, that's why I don't like to even play much before I go on, because I like part of the concerts for me just to be discovering the piano again. You know, like half of the concerts, me just discovering a piano. Wow, that's a neat sound. That's why I hate to play second sets in solo. I sit down and I go, wasn't I just sitting here a minute ago? Didn't I do this already? You know, it just doesn't feel like as fresh. So I like it to be fresh, and it's a journey. And I really cannot tell you. I may end up playing, you know, body and soul. I have no idea. But for me, it's especially solo, where I can not play any tunes if I want to, and I can just follow it. The idea is to get my hands on the piano, disappear, and enjoy the sensuality of the touch and the sensuality of the sound in my ears. Or the spirituality, whatever. To me, sensuality, the great thing about music is that it doesn't have any morality, you know. In society, sensuality and spirituality seems to be on opposite sides of the spectrum, especially with all the people we have that legislate on spiritual matters, you know. In music, sensuality is just, this feels good. And then spirituality is just, you go, thank you to whoever it is that just gave you this music. So sensuality is getting in that space, and then spirituality is just being grateful for it, you know? That's what's great about music.
We're talking to Kenny Warner. In a few minutes, we're going to sit down with Steve Gadd. And Kenny Warner knows Steve Gadd. Played with him in the 80s?
We played with Eddie Gomez's band a number of times. We did a tour together. I loved Steve. What a great guy. And obviously, his playing, he is an icon, a legend.
Yeah,
I can't say enough about Steve Gadd.
I'm tremendously nervous for this interview. I was nervous for you, but now I'm feeling pretty good.
You carry that into the next one. Just don't care about doing a good interview.
That's it. Don't focus too much. There you go. Let the beauty flow out of it. I want to ask you very seriously about, just real briefly, about the difference between the improvisational style that you're going to be performing at 4 p.m. today at the Lyric Theater and putting together an album in a studio. 2006, you did No Beginning, No End. It has been rightly praised by critics across the spectrum. And tell me a little bit about what it was about.
It's not the difference between playing live and improvisation or recording. It's the difference between whether I'm functioning as a improviser or a composer.
Okay.
So, for example, that one I wrote for a wind ensemble featuring Joe Lovano. Obviously, when I write, I'm just putting notes together. It's the same thing. I have a sort of a composition style. It's the same thing. I have no idea what I'm writing, and I'm not attached to what it's going to be. I just keep playing with the notes, and then I save. I do it on computers. I save as, and I change some things. I save as. And the thing sort of shapes into something. And way later in the process, I say, wow, wouldn't it be great if it was this? I'll give you a great example. I have several big band records out. One of them's called Institute of Higher Learning. And on there, I did an arrangement of the House of the Rising Sun, you know, the old pop tune. Mm-hmm. And I didn't set out to write an arrangement of the House of the Rising Sun. I was sitting down playing drums, and I was playing a bass drum pattern I liked. So I said, let me give that bass drum pattern to a trombone. And I just wrote that down. And then I just started writing a bunch of different things in different documents over the bass drum thing. And I didn't know where I was going, textures, this and that. And all of a sudden in the process, I thought, right here, just where I think it would be nothing but textures, I'm going to quote the House of the Rising Sun. Because it just came to me. So I quoted it. But then it came up again later. And then I'm 60% done with the chart. And I said, could this be an arrangement of the House of the Rising Sun? So, and it was. I mean, there's 2 minutes and 30 seconds go by before you even hear the House of the Rising Sun. But I like that same feeling. I feel like there is controlling things, and then there is, you know, just being in the driver's seat or getting the passenger seat and allowing some force greater than yourself to drive. And I try to do that. I don't try to do that. I mean, that's my aim when I compose and when I And when I, so my records, let's say the cross between that, the hybrid, would be a trio record, which I just did, mm-hmm. called The Melody. It's just coming out with my band for 15 years, Ari Honig and Johannes Weidmuller. So that's an improvising group, yet we're playing compositions. But the compositions I bring in were the ones that have been crafted into almost like a written thing, that the way we're improvising is so clear that you could have written it down. So now that's the collection I record in the next record. But everything comes, gets sort of just like, you know, just like diamonds come out. You know, you compress coal and you get a diamond. Real time, surrendering to the energy, and the thing turns into a diamond. For me, turns into a diamond. But I'm not one of those guys can set out to write a samba. To me, if you set out to write a samba, the bad news is you've written a samba. And who the hell needs another samba?
Kenny Warner performing at 4 p.m. today at the Lyric Theater as part of the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. A pianist, a composer, as he said, an author. If you know someone interested in performing and really wants to sort of unlock creativity, his book is called Effortless Mastery, Liberating the Master Musician Within. It's become really become kind of a university textbook, as NPR said, hasn't it?
It is in many schools, and it's read all over the world, and all I have to do is get all the people that read that book to actually hear me play.
I mean,
and that's it.
Really remarkable.
I would not be on at 4 o'clock. I would be on at 8 o'clock.
Are you amazed at the success of the book?
I really am. You know, I started teaching, and I just opened my mouth, and this stuff started coming out. And students were freaking out. And then I did it at an IAJE once, the International Jazz Educators, and suddenly everybody in the country knew that I had said this, and all of a sudden, people were calling me to do lectures at universities. And again, that book came out in real time. I just evolved as I gave these talks. And eventually, I just recorded a three-day clinic I did, and that, after editing it, of course, became the book. So, you know, you really never know.
Well, my cue to get to break. Kenny Warner, we'll see you at 4 p.m. at the Lyric Theater, here at the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. Let's get a short break. Thank you so much, by the way.
Thanks, Kenny, for having me.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Short break, and we're going to come back with Steve Gadd in 90 seconds. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, there's a new campaign aimed at making solar-powered energy more affordable for local homeowners. How does it work? How much does solar really cost, and what could it save you? We'll talk to the experts on that. Then, second hour, discovering the fountain of youth. We talk about the science of aging. All of that Wednesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
It may seem like just a basketball court, but this Baltimore rec center provides something vital to a neighborhood plagued by drugs and violence.
We are mom, dad, aunt, cousin. They come here to get what they don't have at home.
A visit to the Lillian S. Jones Recreation Center later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
And welcome back to Connections. Our next connection was made in 1975. Paul Simon released a smash hit in his song, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. What his fans did not know was that in the studio there had been a bit of a struggle to complete the song. The chorus had been no problem. Everyone was happy with the chorus. But something was a little lacking in the verses. And that's when a bit of musical magic happened. Percussionist Steve Gadd was working on variations of a theme, and producer Phil Ramone heard it. Now, Gadd, being the humble self he has always been, gives Phil Ramone the credit for identifying the riff that then became a legend. And I'm guessing this song would not have had nearly the success it did without this remarkable and tasty opening, all thanks to Steve Gadd.
problem is all inside your head, she said to me.
How good is that? Steve Gadd's a Rochester native. It is not hyperbole to say he might be the finest percussionist ever, and he performs Friday at the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. Sold out Friday night, but first he's my guest on Connections. It is great to have you here, Steve.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You had a nice little reunion with Kenny Warner there, by the way. That was
I haven't seen Kenny in a long time, but we had a lot of fun together, and he's a really funny guy.
I mean, is there any musician you haven't played with?
Yeah, I'm sure there are, but I'm still trying to hunt them all down. Though, you know,
who's at the top of your list? What musician have
No, you can't do that.
You can't do that?
All, whoever I'm playing with is at the top of my list, you know what I mean?
Now, that story, I've heard you tell that story about 50 Ways, and I love that story because, to me, it encompasses a number of important Gadd themes, which is, first of all, humility. Of course, you give Phil Ramone and Paul Simon and everybody else the credit, but that's your tasty riff there.
Well, it's the truth. Like, the whole situation is a process. It isn't an event. And, you know, we had been rehearsing the song, and we had played through it a few different times and listened to playbacks and were analyzing it. And, you know, at one point, I didn't go into the control room to listen to a playback. I knew we didn't have it. And I was just staying out in the drum booth and, you know, sort of just practicing. I did that a lot. During the 70s, I was in the studio a lot. And they just, you know, Phil heard something I was practicing and, you know, suggested that I try that. So, I mean, it's like it's a collaboration and an agreement, you know what I mean? So that's the way it worked out.
And did you know, because as you have said, you knew at that point the chorus was great. Once you locked in that opening, that line, that riff, and the verses were done, did you know it was going to be a smash?
No, I didn't know. I mean, I was, you know, I was still new in the recording industry, but those were great years. So there was a lot. I mean, I was playing a lot of different kinds of music but it was a pleasant surprise when Paul liked the groove, and the album Still Crazy After All These Years was a great album, and it was a surprise that it was such a big hit. I heard, you know, they were playing it all over the place. It was like pretty amazing.
Well, you're playing on Friday night here in Rochester. Rochester always loves having you back. I imagine it's always fun for you to get back here. Mm-hmm. How often are you back in Rochester?
Not often enough. I have, you know, family here. My brother and his wife and daughter live here, and I have a lot of cousins and lots of friends. I grew up here. I went to grammar school, high school, and college here, and then went away for about 20 years and came back and lived here until about 8 years ago. So I've got a lot of roots here.
You grew up in a town that, this may surprise some people to hear, but you go back, you know, 65 years ago, Rochester had a very intimate music scene. You were able to go out and see Dizzy and a number of other performers throughout the years. What was the city like back then, having a chance to get that close to these performers? I mean, Gene Krupa, Max Roach, Oscar Peterson.
It was unbelievable. And my parents and my grandparents and uncle were very supportive, and they loved music, and they loved seeing me sit in, and at the time my brother and I were tap dancing, so we would do the whole thing, and we'd go to the Ridgecrest Inn on Sunday afternoons, and every Sunday afternoon, you know, we'd run into Chucky and Gap Mangione and their family would bring those kids out, and we'd all end up sitting in with these people, and it was great. The artists were very receptive, very friendly, and they would, you know, they would come back into town. It wasn't like they just came in once. They were making this circus, so they would, you'd get to know them after, you know, after a few times.
And maybe sit in with them.
Oh, we would always sit in.
You were 9 in 1954 when you sat in with Gene Krupa, right?
Right.
Amazing.
It was amazing. And there were other clubs in town, like the Pithod and the Oxford Lounge and the S&B Lounge that brought in organ groups. So there was a lot going on. I played in drum and bugle corps. I was in the Rochester Crusaders. I started out in the Ridge Culver Statesmen. So I was doing a whole bunch of different things, and it was there was just, you know, music around the clock. A lot of different clubs.
Maybe I'm just trying to connect too much here, but, you know, I think back to those days, and, you know, I think back to the descriptions of you going to see Krupa and Dizzy Gillespie and everybody else coming to Rochester in intimate settings. And, of course, we don't really have that anymore, but it feels like for a week out of the year with a jazz festival, we kind of do.
You know, it's great. I was running around last night, and I hadn't, you know, after all these years, I've never was able to get to this festival. And I heard some great music last night. And you can get up close and personal. I mean, when I went and saw Gene Krupa at the Ridgecrest Inn, I was as far away from him as I am to you right now. So I could sit there and watch how he played, see his feet move and everything. And that's the way it was with anyone I went to go hear. It wasn't, I just didn't go hear him, I could watch him, and it was tremendous. So, and it was like that last night. I heard some great music, and it was, you know, like I went to the Montage and saw Cat Edmondson, who was great. I saw Dawn Thomas at the Xerox. Roman, I saw I can't remember the names of the band. There was a band down the street from the Montage playing in a tent where they sounded amazing. And I saw a big band in the big tent at 6 o'clock with a lot of guys from Rochester playing. And it was great to be able to get that close and to see people just having so much fun playing music and to have it be supported so warmly. So.
It's great to be here. It's remarkable. And we're talking to Steve Gadd. I would never presume to tell a recording artist, a legend, what to do with the microphone, but because we had a quick switch out with Kenny, can you grab that mic or just get nice and close to it? There you go.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve. And it's Friday night, 8 p.m. It's sold out. Steve's here to break some news. He told me he's going to tell us all who his special guest is. I'm sure.
Yeah, you know what? I'd love to tell you that, but I don't even know myself.
Come on. You
no,
know.
I know, but I can't, you know.
I know you're not going to tell us,
spoil
but I will tell our audience, if you're lucky enough to be going on Friday night, that there is a mystery special guest as part of the Steve Gadd Band and the celebrating 70 years for Steve Gadd, and a lot of speculation, a lot of people speculating on James Taylor, Eric Clapton, someone else, you know, I mean, you raised your eyebrows a little, but you can't say.
I can't say.
It's going to be fun.
We're going to give it 150%. You know, we got a great band. I love playing with these guys. Larry Goldings, Jimmy Johnson. Larry Golding plays keyboard. Jimmy Johnson plays bass. Walt Fowler plays trumpet and flugelhorn. And Michael Landau plays guitar. And I love these guys. And we have a lot of fun, not only hanging out, but playing music. So, looking forward to it.
And you're going out next month on the road again with James Taylor. You're going to be back at CMAC on, I think, July 12th. So we'll see you back here in about a month, less than a month here. I've read you talk about the difference between recording in studio and playing live. And you said something very interesting about James Taylor, because you said that, you know, that when you are live, your job is to kind of match some of the energy and sometimes the loudness of the other musicians on stage. But it's a little different with JT, that it's a little, that he is kind of a rock from the studio to the stage. He is really even.
Well, James
amazing.
James is a great artist. He's a fantastic guitar player. He's a tremendous singer, a great writer. And he has a lot of different configurations of groups that he puts together. Sometimes we've gone out with just James, piano and drums, and one background singer. We've gone out with James, piano, drums, electric guitar, and three background singers, and one of them plays fiddle. And we'll be going this summer with the three background singers, James singing and playing guitar, electric guitar, keyboards, bass, two horns, and percussion and drums. So there's a lot of dynamic mm-hmm. range, and there's a lot of dynamic range in James's shows too. They start out very minimally, and they just you know, and then they go, you know, sky high, and then they come back down again. So that's, you know, a lot of other shows, they don't, the dynamic spread isn't as great.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really challenging, and it's fun, and the crowd loves them. So it's just nice to be a part of that energy.
Do you feel at any point, I don't even know if this distinction matters to you, but at any point have you felt like I'm a part of this band as opposed to describing yourself as a session musician?
I don't really think, you know, about things like that. I mean, whatever I'm doing, that's what I'm a part of. Whatever I'm doing is the best thing I'm doing. I don't think about doing other things or playing with other bands. I can't do that. I just put myself into the people I'm working with and enjoy every moment. And then when that's over, you know, it's sad that it's over, but, you know, we say we'll see you the next time and then go on and do something else and put the same amount of energy into the next thing. And that's what... That's what keeps it fun, because when everybody does that, it just takes it to another level.
I have always loved James Taylor, and I've always appreciated his voice, but I've heard people say that he's underappreciated for just how remarkable of a singer he is in terms of just on note, never misses, really remarkable. What do you think?
I agree. I listen to him, you know, on the road, and he just... The stuff that he does and the way he phrases and the notes that he gets are, you know, I'm in awe. And he just seems to get better and better. And he's got this new album coming out, and he wrote some beautiful, beautiful songs. And I feel very honored and joyous to be a part of that.
Talking to Steve Gadd, Rochester native, legendary percussionist, who is performing a sold-out show on Friday night at the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. Then we'll be back at CMAC next month with James Taylor. Maybe James Taylor will be with him on Friday night. Steve is not saying who the special guests will be, but it is going to be a great show no matter what happens. Now, if we peel back a little bit of your own history, I want to try to fit in a few questions from some of our listeners who love your work. And you go back to your time in, you know, you think about the war. You didn't want to go fight in Vietnam.
No, I didn't want to do that.
And you end up going, where did you go to Maryland playing an army band?
During my last year of college, because the draft was so, was dominating everybody's lives at the time.
Yeah.
Most everyone that was healthy when they got out of school was going to end up going to war. So during my last year at Eastman, my teacher, John Beck, had arranged some auditions for me with some service bands in the Washington area. And these bands didn't go to Vietnam. They did gigs in Washington.
Sounded good to you?
Yeah, it sounded good. And I auditioned, and I got it. So I went in for 3 years instead of... And stayed. I was at Fort Meade, Maryland, and the band toured the United States, went to different high schools, and played concerts. And I met some great guys. And looking back, it was good duty. I mean, I hated it when I was in because I wanted to be growing my hair and doing other things. But looking back, it was pretty cool.
And I've heard a quote from you, and me not being a percussionist, I'd love for you to explain this. You couldn't have known at the time when you were in the Army band how much it would pay off, but you go to Steely Dan, Asia, and you said, quote, my Army days paid off because I could read the chart.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could read, you know, before then, but in the Army, we had arrangers and we rehearsed every day. And the arrangers were writing new charts. So, and the best way to learn how to read is to have to sight read every day. And the more it's like anything else, it's like the more you read books, the better your reading gets. So the better my reading of music got. And back in the 70s, you had to read in the studio. There was more reading going on back then than there is now. So it worked out good for Asia.
I'd like to listen to what I think is probably the tastiest part of Asia, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about how it all came together. So let's listen to Steely Dan, Steve Gadd, Asia. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, what I remember is we recorded it live, and they had been working on this track with different players, and apparently they didn't have what they wanted, and the band was well rehearsed and the chart was up because other guys had been playing it, and we got through it in a couple of takes. And I think that what was, you know, they just kept on saying they wanted it to be sort of crazy at the end, and back in those days when you were doing pop dates, it was, you know, you didn't really want to get really busy, so it was going against the grain to do that. But you know, I just sort of I went for it, figure you could go far that, you know, in terms of busyness, and then we could tone it back a little bit. But when the crazier it was, the more they liked it, and the rest is history.
It is great stuff. Talking to Steve Gadd, Rochester native and legendary percussionist. I have to give credit as I got ready for this interview today. One of my good friends in Manhattan is a very good drummer himself, not to your level, but his name's Chris Wilford, and Chris is a huge fan. And if I could, I just want to read a comment from him because I think this helps us understand the impact you've had. I think it's easier to look at a frontman. A James Taylor, a Clapton, and understand the popular appeal. And maybe you get less of that, and maybe you prefer it that way as the man in the back. But let me read Chris's comment because I think this helps encapsulate what Steve Gadd has meant. Quote, guitar players had Clapton, we had Gadd. You have your general musician players, your pop passersby who heard Ringo and Charlie, Moon and Bonzo, John Bonham to the riffraff. But once you got hooked by one of them, you found Gadd. It just is. We all learned to play Honky Tonk Woman or Come Together or thought we played rock and roll fairly well, and then we heard him. Was it the way he tuned his kit? Thumpy, sort of dead, a sound based on the Blue Evens hydraulic heads he used, and the old Zildjian K cymbals, his clear command of chord drumming and rudiments? Maybe all of the above. In the end, who cares? He changed the way we played. What do you think?
I don't have words. You don't set out to do that. You just set out to play music, and I was always happy about the people that wanted me to play. I love to play. I love all kinds of music, and I'm fortunate that I got the opportunity to do a lot of different things. And the fact, you know, and the way I look at what I do is I just try to, when I play, I try to emulate people that I've heard that did things that I loved, and guys that took the time to show me things. So I'm just sort of, you know, duplicating what they did. And I mean, I think that's the way we all learn, by hearing things we like and trying to copy it. So, and if I've helped people and they like it and they've had, and it's given them some joy and they're having fun, you know, I'm glad to share it, you know.
Well, you certainly have made that kind of an impact. Who are you listening to now when you're not performing with others, or what other percussionists are you loving right now?
I love the drums. So I learn something from everybody that I listen to. I don't even know the guys' names, but I heard people last night playing that killed me. And the drummer with Cat Edmondson, he sort of played like with one brush all night, and he had like a mallet, and he was playing orchestra bells with his left hand, and it was so beautiful, and it sounded so simple, but it was, you know, but it was very difficult to do. What he did was unbelievable. So, you know, whoever I see, my eyes go to the drummer, and I can learn something that they do that I want to do. So, I mean, growing up, I listened to Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich and Louie Belson and Max Roach and Elvin Jones, Philly Joe Jones. And I continue to listen to new drummers. I don't know all their names, but there's some great players out there now. Okay, so like there's Chris Dave. Have you heard of Chris Dave? Mark Giuliana. He's a great player. I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, but there are some fantastic guys out there that are doing new things. And but in general, my ears and eyes go right to the drummer, and I'm studying whoever it is that's playing. I can learn something from everybody.
One thing that you have said in interviews before that has changed a bit is that music used to be a little bit more about listening experience, and now there's more visuals. There's more of an effort to sort of produce up popular music songs, whether it's videos or live performances and sets. And does that bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me, but it doesn't really involve me too much. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like that's another generation.
But it's hard for you to get into that kind of stuff?
Well, it's a younger, you know, it's like, it's younger, beautiful, you know what I mean? Great dancers, guy, you know, it's just a whole, it's another thing involved, plus the playing. So, probably if I was young, I would have to try and fit into that. But thank God I'm 70 and I don't.
Now, you've done how many different studio albums? 600 plus now? I mean, I don't know if you ever
count. I don't
know.
I haven't counted.
It's hundreds, right? Because once in a while I'll listen to a song, and whether I'm with my friend Chris or somebody else, they'll say, you know, that's Gad. And I'll say, I should have known. But is there an album that you did, that you worked on, that you look back on and you say, damn, that was good, and that should have gotten a little bit more run? I'd like more people to hear that.
You know, I don't think about things like that. I if I was looking back at, you know, things that I've done and one album stood out, it would probably be the Chick Corea album, not because it needed to get more airplay, but it was the Leprechaun album. And it was because it was soon after I got to New York. And it involved everything that I had been studying, you know, up until that point. You know, it was like, technically, I was able to use a lot of different technical things musically in playing that album. I was sight reading it. I was reading off the piano score. It was done live. So it was very challenging. And musically and technically and compositionally, to try and come up with those drum parts that were sort of, you know, I sort of thought of orchestra things and tried to approach certain parts like that. And I've never done another album live like that. So that one album stands out just because of what happened when it went down. Not because it's better than other things. It's just that I never did one live reading, you know, and with the solos and everything happening right then. And it was like, that was it. Did it, and it was done, and it was very rewarding.
Got about 30 seconds left. I wish people could see you. They will see you on Friday. You look great.
You're
70.
70.
You look great. You're still playing. You're touring. How long? What's next for you? I mean, I know you're going out with James Taylor next month, but what do you want to, you going to keep doing it essentially the same way?
Yeah, I'm going to keep doing it. I can't ever imagine not playing. I don't know if I'll be traveling as much, you know, later on, but I'll be playing as long as I can. I love to play.
The city is so remarkable during Jazz Week, isn't it?
It was fantastic.
Isn't it a great place to be? I was walking around with my 3-year-old son last night, and I said, I'm so proud of this city.
I'm proud of it, and it's great to hear. You hear such great players, man. It's unbelievable. You know, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, as we wrap up with Steve Gadd, I will say, go out and see him if you can on Friday. I know it's sold out. Find a way in, sneak into the show. Friday night, 8 o'clock at the Eastman. He's going to have a special guest. We don't know who it'll be, and if you miss him there, you can see him at CMAC next month. But it's an honor. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And that's Steve Gadd. Our thanks to Kenny Warner earlier this hour and the great folks from the Jazz Festival for making these interviews possible today. Let's listen to a little bit more Steve Gadd, Paul Simon, and thanks for listening to Connections. You don't need to discuss much, just drop off the key and leave and get yourself free. She said, it grieves me so to see you in such pain. I wish there was some.